Welcome back to the Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle, and I'm sure, like me, many of you got up a bit early this morning to watch the boxing in the Olympics and the incredible Kelly Harrington, who secured at least a silver medal in the boxing semi-final. She's through to the final of her weight on Sunday, and we're all cheering for her. What an incredible achievement, and what a cool, funny and dedicated young woman she is, from Dublin's inner city, not too far away from me in the North Strand. And she's taking so much pride and delight in being able to lift all of our spirits. What a woman, going for gold on Sunday. Well, today, as the controversy over Catherine Zappone's declining of the UN Special Envoy position and her gathering that she held for 50 people in the Merrion Hotel rages on, we're going to be talking about COVID-19 restrictions in a different way. The ones that have meant women during this pandemic have been experiencing all sorts of things, including pregnancy loss, having babies, and generally going through everything to do with maternity on their own. And I want to read you a post that was posted on the COVID in Her Shoes Facebook page, which really puts it into stark reality for us. So this woman said, "On our first pregnancy in May 2020, I was told that I had a miscarriage alone. In June, I was given confirmation that the baby was no more and that the medication I had to take had worked alone. In August, I found out there was a heartbeat with our second pregnancy alone. I went to each and every scan alone. I was diagnosed with preeclampsia alone. They induced me alone. My waters broke alone. I laboured alone. Scared shitless and in tears, I was one of many on that pre-labour ward alone. In April 2021, our beautiful baby girl was born via emergency C-section, and I was, inverted commas, lucky enough to have my husband by my side. Then I was told that my preeclampsia had worsened postpartum and I was at risk of stroke and organ failure alone. I was expected to look after my baby solo and also myself for that week in hospital, bar the 2 hours my husband was allowed to visit alone. I was told I had developed cellulitis over my wound alone. Unfortunately, our baby was admitted to Crumlin Children's Hospital at 8 days old with suspected meningitis, and I had to sit in triage with her alone. Only one of us could be with her each day over 10 days she was in hospital. Once again, I found myself alone. It took a village of supportive friends and family to get our little girl to where we are today. Yet 13 weeks postpartum, when it comes to the Irish health system, I still feel very much alone." And that's just one of many devastating stories. So today, we're going to be talking about the fact that you can go to the pub and to restaurants inside with your COVID cert, loads of people there. You can have a gathering of up to 200 people outdoors. But if you're a pregnant woman in Ireland today, you are pretty much, as that woman said, on your own. Waterford Whispers News does great satire, and they had a story this week that said pregnant women to deliver a child indoors in pub so partner can attend birth. Well, it's also National Breastfeeding Week, so we thought we'd also talk about that on the podcast. And I spoke to Evie Nuhulavon, broadcaster, academic, mathematician and musician and assistant professor in UCD. She gave birth to her second son in the pandemic, and she's also a campaigner for breastfeeding. She's in the Baby Feeding Law Group Ireland and also the mother representative on the National Maternity Hospital Steering Committee. Emma Carroll also joined me on the podcast. She's an environmental scientist and farmer living in County Kildare. She has one daughter, Liv, who was born at the start of restrictions on maternity care in April 2020. Emma runs the page In Our Shoes COVID Pregnancy on Instagram and Facebook to give voice to those affected by restrictions on maternity care. They both talked to me about issues that are so important for women at the moment, and I began by asking Evie to tell me her experience of giving birth during COVID.
Well, I was very lucky, Roisin, in that it was my second pregnancy in the pandemic. And I really feel sorry for anyone who's having their first baby during the pandemic, because it was a very, very different experience. You know, going to every single appointment in the hospital on your own. I had one morning where I was a little bit worried about the baby. I hadn't felt him kicking for a couple of hours. And, you know, that's just a horrible, horrible feeling. And to just say, okay, Carlos, my husband, I will call you later. You know, the fact that he just couldn't come in with me, because that was a bit terrifying. And, you know, if I was to get bad news on my own for that, so a very different experience. But look, we both said at the time, look, it's a pandemic. You know, we'll take it in our stride. And we did, because it was second time round. But it's only now, actually, looking back in hindsight, I missed seeing the scans together and having a cup of coffee afterwards and looking at the photos and all that kind of stuff. So while it was totally fine and thankfully everything went well, and thankfully my labour was grand because, you know, it was second time round and I was very lucky. I think in total from contraction starting, I think it was 3 hours until he was born. And so he drove me to the hospital and literally within maybe an hour, they were just like, you can come in now. And he was able to stay for the whole time and the baby just kind of popped out a little bit. But, you know, had it been my first time, I would have been a very different mother in terms of being just a little bit worried, because you do need someone there to hold the bowl that you're puking into, and to, you know, give you a towel when you've popped out of the shower, and to, you know, hold your hand when you're in the middle of a contraction trying to walk to the toilet and stuff like that. So yeah, just a very different experience giving birth in the pandemic.
Yeah, and we're going to go into more detail into later. And in my intro, I read out one story from Emma's Facebook page, which sort of, this woman went through absolutely every possible thing you could. And, you know, it's relative for each person, but I think it's important to say that it was a different experience. And it's, you know, just because your experience isn't necessarily as bad as someone else's, it still takes away from that very special time in a woman's life. And we will talk more in detail about that later. But I wanted to talk to you first of all about breastfeeding. So it's National Breastfeeding Week. It's celebrated every year, August 1st to August 7th. Mm-hmm. And you became a bit of an accidental from Rosa Tralee to all the other things you've done, Evie. And now you're a breastfeeding spokesmodel. That's terrible. Spokesperson.
Yes. And it is accidental, Roisin. And I am laughing about it because, you know, I really didn't think I'd be the person advocating for breastfeeding. But I've realised so much since the birth of my second boy. And I only came to it accidentally because back in January, we had a lactation consultant, a public lactation consultant in the area where I live in Dublin. And there's only 4 in the whole entire country. And when I had her and my boy was born with a tongue tie and with a tooth, and I really needed someone to talk to. And I'm that kind of a stubborn person or silly person that, you know, if I can't do it by myself, it must be a sign that I can't do it. But the fact that the lactation consultant was just there and I was able to ask her questions and she was able to help me through it. And then, you know, on those awful mornings when you haven't had any sleep and there's a breastfeeding group and you're just like, oh, will I log on? Well, I will, because, you know, it's there now. And it was just so helpful to see the other mums in the exact same position. And when in January she was reassigned as a public health nurse, and I was just distraught because this lactation consultant had absolutely saved me in the first, you know, 10 weeks of the baby. And I just thought all the poor mums who are having their first baby and wouldn't have this support. And so I just got on Twitter about it. And it just turned into something. And I found out so much since about research into breastfeeding, how underfunded maternity services and breastfeeding services are in Ireland. And it's just kind of brought me to advocating, because I just feel that women and children have been, you know, kind of set aside for a whole century in this country. And it's about time that institutions and industries didn't actually get the first word on it. And so I really feel that maternity services and, you know, breastfeeding supports as just one part of that just need a little bit of focus from the powers that be. They need funding and they need a little bit of policy support, and they just need a little bit of attention, because if we give them that, you know, mums, women in general, are very strong, very resourceful, but actually we can't do everything without a little bit of support. So I just feel that this is a problem that can be easily solved. And that's why I've kind of started advocating for these things. Mm.
Well, I totally agree with you. As someone who had twins, and I mean, I didn't do brilliant, and I lasted probably 10 months, but, and it wasn't all the time, you know, I did a bit of formula as well, but I found the experience of breastfeeding so empowering, and I was lucky in that it worked and they seemed to really want it.
Well,
so I didn't have to do too much struggling, but I did end up paying, I think, for a couple of sessions with a lactation consultant, because I wanted to make sure it was right and that I could get as much support. And it really was so helpful, even just to confirm that what I was doing was okay.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
So everything you're saying makes so much sense, but I don't think it's made a priority, you know?
No, and just on that, Roisin, like, you know, Bonnie Baha did a survey last year and they found out that on average, women are paying €450 for extra supports. You know, so immediately, so I'm in a postcode lottery because we had a free public lactation consultant. And then second of all, well, if you can't afford that, you're kind of bunched. But then it's out of the frying pan into the fire, because then if you are forced to use formula where you mightn't have wanted to, if you wanted to, absolutely, that's your choice. But if you didn't want to, and now you, all of a sudden you have to because it's not working, you know, that's another expense on your family. And so it becomes unnecessarily expensive when, if the government actually funded it at the beginning stages, so much more afterwards would be just, it would just be a great investment, because, you know, the health benefits for both baby and mum down the line are, I would say, almost immeasurable. And so this is the thing. It shouldn't be a postcode lottery, and it shouldn't be dependent on if you can pay for the support or not.
And just to give a bit of context for people as well, because some people will say, oh, you know, it's putting too much pressure on women and not everyone can breastfeed, which is absolutely true. Mm-hmm. And it's not for everyone. So we should say that at the outset.
Absolutely.
But just to give a bit of context with statistics, fewer than 6% of babies in Ireland are exclusively breastfed at 6 months. And the European average is 25%. Mm-hmm. So that's quite stark. And nationally, 63.8% of women initiate breastfeeding at their baby's first feed, compared to rates of 90% in Australia, 81% in the UK and 79% in the US. And we are, for some reason, and we can maybe talk about that a bit, pretty bad on this. The World Health Organization says that breastfeeding is one of the most effective ways to ensure child health and survival. And the theme for this breastfeeding week is Protect Breastfeeding, a Shared Responsibility. Mm-hmm. So why do you think it has become where we're really trailing behind so many people?
It's a complex question, Roisin. And I just want to add one more statistic to that. 80% of Irish mums would like to breastfeed, have said that they would like to breastfeed. So already, what you said there, 63% have the first feed. So already there's a drop off of that 20%. What happened to those mums who wanted to breastfeed and didn't end up? Now, there's lots of reasons, but if it's a matter that they don't feel supported by their healthcare providers, that's the first thing. So we need to make sure that our maternity services are properly staffed, because when your baby is screaming that first night when you've never had a baby screaming before and they're fully your responsibility and something isn't working and they're not feeding, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, you just need somebody to come in and just go, do you know what? If you hold them this way, if you try this, will I express the colostrum for you? Here's a little bit of heat to maybe help the milk come. There's so much with that. So first of all, we haven't fully and properly staffed our maternity wards. So that's the first thing. All of the staff that are on the maternity wards need to be up to speed on breastfeeding, and not all of them are at the moment. So that's the second thing. GPs also, I think, should require compulsory training in breastfeeding, because they're almost your first port of call when you're pregnant. And you kind of need to be setting yourself up mentally for this as well. But I think one of the most important things, Roisin, is that the culture of breastfeeding has kind of been lost, because in the 70s and 80s, women were bombarded by the formula companies with marketing and messaging that actually formula was better for your baby than breastfeeding. Because do you know what? Your baby's really hungry and your breast milk isn't actually going to fill them up. And this is absolute nonsense. Like, we've done all the research now. We know that that is not the case. Cluster feeding is normal. It doesn't mean that they're hungry. It just means that they need more of your milk to come in, and that's what they're setting themselves up for. And their tummies are growing the whole time. It doesn't mean that they're hungry. And the 70s and 80s had a massive influx of all these formula products. And they were in the hospitals, and, you know, in the hospitals, you know, nurses didn't always know best, and they were just like, well, why don't you give them a bottle and then they'll be grand and I can send you home then, because their blood sugars will be up and all this kind of stuff.
Evine, can I interrupt you there for a second? Because
yeah.
I just want to paint that picture. I mean, I think it's so, I don't want to use the word evil, but I feel like that's kind of where it feels like to me. If you think about these companies now, who was making the money? Who was in charge of these companies? Were there women CEOs of these formula milk companies?
Most certainly not. No.
Yeah.
I mean,
so there's all these men making a load of money off all these women by lying, essentially, by telling them that what they had in their body wasn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
And the hospitals colluding, the state colluding with this as well. It makes me so angry, and I can understand completely why you have kind of fallen into being an accidental spokesperson, because, I mean, you know, you're in that situation now. But anyway, that's just a little side rant. But just to be, to paint that picture, there's people making a ton of money off women telling them not to do what comes very naturally to them. That's what really makes me mad.
And I, let's go back to what I was saying about culture in a second, because you, you make a really, really important point there, Roisin, because, and this is where I just get so cross, because what they've done is this capitalist regime, let's say, because these are, they're an industry. The formula companies, they're an industry, and all they want is profits. They don't care about your health, your baby's health. They just want to make money. But they're feeding on your guilt. So they're making you think, oh my God, my baby isn't getting enough food. I have to feed them this formula. So it's the epitome of the patriarchy making the woman feel inadequate. But what they've done now, which I, is making my mind blow, because what they've done now, and I've seen it recently on social media, they're saying that, and I'm putting in inverted commas if you could see me, the pressure to breastfeed is anti-feminist. So this capitalist regime, this patriarchy that are making you feel guilty for having a hungry baby because you've breastfed and you should formula feed, is now saying, and all those women who are making you feel bad that you're not breastfeeding, you know, you tell them where to go because you should just formula feed. And I just, I cannot get over it, because the only, we need formula, okay? Not everybody can breastfeed. There are cases where it's actually physically not possible for either the mom to feed or the baby to feed. So we need formula, and I'm not saying we don't, but it's a healthcare product that should only be promoted by healthcare professionals. And we lost the culture. So our mothers are telling us as new mums, you know what, you actually need to be given the formula. And so we're fighting against our maternal role models, because that's what they were told. And we're also fighting against, unfortunately, some healthcare professionals, because that's what they were told. So we need to re-educate everybody. But if we think about it, and Sabine Higgins said this in her speech, it's on YouTube if you want to look it up. It's the launch of the Breastival conference that started last weekend. And she just said, you know, 100 years ago, nearly 100% of babies in Ireland were breastfed. And what happened is we let the formula companies in and we believed them. We believed the marketing. And look, advertising would be grand if it was just giving you straight up information, but it's not. Advertising is there to make you feel like you need something that you didn't actually need. That's why they pump millions into it. And if they didn't, the formula would probably be a lot cheaper, but it's a $70 billion global industry. We are giving money to formula companies in Ireland, subsidizing them. I do not understand that. If we gave that money that we were subsidizing to these food companies, to the actual maternity services, we would solve the breastfeeding rate.
Even that is just so rage making as well, that we're giving them money. I mean, how complicit is our government in this? Like, I mean, without going into the territory that's going to get us into trouble, but you know, again, surely their responsibility, whatever about people wanting to make a fast buck, you know, commercial enterprises wanting to sell loads of formula, you can understand that thing. But the government surely should be on the side of women and on the side of the health and on the science.
They should be. So I'm not, I don't want to suggest that people are complicit, but I think people are uneducated and unaware. And I think, you know, this goes back to a lot of diversity. I wonder how many people on cabinet have breastfed, you know, I would say it's not the majority. So I actually think we need to educate our politicians, because one way we can fix this is to legislate for the World Health Organization code on infant feeding. And we should have no marketing of any baby food or milk products from 0 to 36 months. That's what the WHO code says. They've been saying it for 40 years and we haven't done it. But if you look at any of the countries that have implemented this code, they are on 90% plus breastfeeding rates. And obviously that's helping their babies, because babies are less likely to get asthma, less likely to get throat infections or gut infections. The mothers are less likely to get cancer. There's less rates of obesity. So many things that will benefit our society. So I think we have to educate our government on this. But I also, something that the Ombudsman for Children said this year really resonated with me. He said a lot of the problems that he sees are because agencies don't want to take on the monetary burden. So if we see this as just a Department of Health issue, where just the Department of Health has to fund the maternity and the breastfeeding services, that's one thing. But actually, if we thought about this in the global sense, where actually if the Enterprise Ireland wasn't funding the formula companies and that money was instead going to the maternity and the breastfeeding strategies, then it wouldn't matter. So we just, I think, have to start thinking about funding as just money in and money out and not on whose book that it lands in. And I think perhaps, you know, putting this issue in the department of the Taoiseach and rather instead of just under one health department and under somebody's accountancy book, you know, that might actually help things as well.
Even before I bring in Emma, I want to ask you about a recent tweet you had about follow-on milk, which I thought was, which got a big, went a little bit viral.
It did. And
you were disappointed in Super Value, who are promoting follow-on milk when it's not necessary. This even when I see the ads for follow-on milk, I'm just like, what even is follow-on milk? Like, it doesn't make any sense. It's just another thing to sell women that their babies don't actually need.
Yeah. And you know, just in case anybody who's listening doesn't know, follow-on milk was only created by the formula companies because in Ireland, in Britain and a couple of other countries, they have made it illegal to advertise baby milks from 0 to 6 months. But after 6 months,
it's a free-for-all.
We haven't put that legislation in. So they created follow-on milk for 6 months onwards. So it's just, you know, it's almost the same as formula one that you might give a baby if they're under 6 months, but it has slightly more sugar, slightly more vanilla, which actually kind of is addictive almost for the babies. And toddler milk, again, formula three milk, which you absolutely do not need to give to your children because they should just have cow's milk at that point. They are solely created as a marketing ploy so that you will get brand recognition. So if I see a certain brand, and they've done the research on this, the research shows you that when a parent sees an ad like this, they actually don't register that it's for 6 months forward. They just think, oh, that's formula for my baby, even if they're younger than 6 months. So the companies know this, and this is why they spend a lot of money on it, targeting first-time moms, because they want your brand loyalty. And it's a purely cynical operation. And this is why we should legislate for the WHO code to ban marketing up to 36 months, because they're doing it in every which way now. So Super Value had that promotion, but I've seen other supermarkets who are giving away a free sample of toddler milk. They're giving away maybe a free bottle or stuff like that. And it's literally just to get you to recognize that brand. You, as a first-time parent, are really valuable to that company, and that's why they're investing in that advertising. And so it's really, really underhanded. It's really, really cynical. And I just want to say that, you know, if 100% of families decided to feed their babies with formula, this WHO code would be all the more important, because you shouldn't be just aggressively advertised at. I can make my food choices without a TV ad. Like the formula that I use for my baby, because he is on formula because I couldn't continue it after 16 weeks with the tooth, unfortunately. So I use a formula, but it's not one that's actually been advertised on television. And, you know, it's something that my husband and I, we decided on because we looked at all the ingredients. And that's how we should be making our decisions, not based on which company has the most money to aggressively market on social media with influencers and everything. So I really feel like we would very much support breastfeeding a lot more if we simply had the legislation to do that.
Yeah, I think we should find out another time who invented follow-on milk, Evie, and get him on a podcast.
Is.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, it's a man.
Of course it's a man.
Yeah. Well, I've been reading up a lot on this, Roisin. So it was a man in France, and there was a baby who was quite poorly. I think his mum had passed away or something. You know, at the time, there was wet nurses and things like that. Like people, you know, women actually made money from being able to breastfeed other people's children. But so Nestle made up this formula, and the baby, according to him and according to his PR, thrived. So he managed to get his message out there. And we all know about Nestle, and we all know about their reputation in Africa. And I don't think that they can sue me for libel, because it's all been documented, you know. And babies died because of the aggressive marketing tactics of formula companies out there, where they had sales reps dress up as nurses and tell mothers formula will be better than you giving breast milk, and doing that to somebody who does not have clean running water that they're able to boil. You know, babies actually died. And I just think that's where we're coming from in terms of the advertising. Companies will go to whatever length it is to make the most profit. We just need to be really aware of that all the time. But these big food industries are not there for your baby's health. They're there for their bottom line and their shareholders. So I really think that this is why I'm really passionate about just getting the code legislated for as soon as possible. And I would just like to educate our legislators who we vote for. And I will be asking them all about this whenever our next election comes up. And
God love anyone who knocks on your door, even Jesus. They'll be there for ages. I'm delighted. Listen, Em, I want to bring you in now. Thanks for listening there. First of all, before we go on to the COVID restrictions and the women that you've been hearing from and advocating for, what do you think about what Evian said there about breastfeeding?
Oh, I like Evian and I could be best friends, because the only thing over the last 16 months that I've kind of become so much more aware of, aside from, you know, the lack of value that is placed on women in terms of these restrictions, also comes back to the unethical practices of formula companies. So I still, and I'd say that with inverted commas, still breastfeed my 15-month-old happily. You know, it was gas at the beginning. People were kind of like, oh, you're breastfeeding. Oh, because, you know, nobody in my family breastfed. No one. And I was like, yeah, yeah, sure. We'll give it a lash. And in my head, again, back down to marketing practices as a first time mother, I was like, sure, we'll get to 6 months, because that's when you stop, isn't it? I mean, like, you know, they definitely have formula after 6 months. In my head, like, I hadn't heard about the WHO code. I hadn't heard about the recommendations to feed to 2 years and beyond. I heard nothing of this. And it just kind of dawned on me, like, how unethical the entire thing is. I mean, even the price of formula, when you think about it, all formula companies have to do is to intercept you at a weak point and to get, not to get you hooked, that's not really the right terminology, but once they break that breastfeeding relationship that you're now reliant on their product, that's it. Like, you're in, now you can come back. I'm not giving people who are listening no hope in saying that you can't relactate in this when you're working with a good lactation consultant. But in saying that, generally speaking, once you make the dive, you're very unlikely to come back, and they've hooked you then, and you're spending 12, 13, 14 euro a pop on a tin of dried cow's milk. And to come back to the point as well, I think the figure was something, it was over 4 million euro anyway, that we know of, that's been directly given to these formula companies. But it's even more than that, because I'm a scientist and I'm a farmer as well. And when you think about it, so that money from, I think it was Enterprise Ireland, it was said that it was from, given directly to the companies. What that doesn't take into account is the other incentive. Basically, the product is further subsidized. So raw milk coming off a farm, there's already massively, you know, there's massive subsidies in that, in terms of cap payments, in terms of basic farm payments, in terms of all these payments. So the formula companies are already receiving a hugely subsidized product for which farmers are working their backsides off and should be fairly paid, but they're not, by the people who are buying it. And yeah, it's just a massively unethical system. And it really infuriates me. The figure that only 6% or less of babies are breastfed at 6 months is shocking. And what's even worse is they don't even have a figure for what, you know, how many are breastfed beyond that, because it's not actually recorded, as far as I know, by GPs and PHNs. So my baby is just well off the radar. Like, we're already weird enough, like, you know, that kind
of you weirdo.
When we got past 6 months, people were like, yeah, I know. People were like, oh, OK, that's nice. And then we kind of kept going, and it came up a couple of months ago. Now, obviously, as your baby grows, like, the feeding frequencies go way down. So she only really feeds like maybe in the morning and at nighttime before bed. But like my mother-in-law, she'll kill me now if I say this, she's over a couple of nights ago, and I was putting Liv down to bed, and she's like, so are you still breastfeeding? And I was like, yeah. And she's kind of like, oh, you know, it's kind of like, it never really dawns on people that babies still need and benefit from breast milk. So there's just a lot of re-education, and it started like the whole formula breast milk conversation and maternity are so really heavily interlinked, because it was my experience when I was in hospital, a first time mother. I hadn't had a great birth experience. It was very, very stressful coming up to it, because I knew I was going to be separated from my partner. And, you know, the actual birth itself didn't go fabulously, and I was totally alone, very weak on a ward. But one thing that worked for us was breastfeeding. So she latched like a dream. And for that, I am eternally grateful, because I'm not going to say actually that it's rare, because I feel like I geared myself up. I was like, my nipples are going to be shredded. I'm not going to be able to, you know, it's going to be horrific. Breastfeeding is supposed to be horrific. And it just wasn't. And I was like, is it actually working properly? Because I'm not feeling any pain. Like, that's how good it went for us. We were really lucky.
I totally relate to what you're saying there. And I don't want to, again, anyone listening who's have trouble, because I know, and I have sisters who have had really bad trouble. So I totally get that it's not something that everyone comes to. But I don't know if there's enough said about when it does work, how amazing it is and what a joyful and beautiful experience. I mean, I looked forward to it. I loved it. I felt really like I was doing what my body was supposed to be doing. It's something, and I wouldn't be the most sort of earth mothery type person, but for some reason it really connected to that part of me, that my body was showing up in the way that, you know, was great for my little babies, and I was able to do something right. I know it doesn't work for everyone, but not enough said about that joy, breastfeeding joy.
It was fabulous. Yeah, I just felt like I was, aside from, like, you know, stepping into what my body was supposed to do and empowering myself, because frankly nobody else was empowering me to do it. And at the same time, as I began to realize the unethical practices of these formula companies, I was literally sticking it to the man. I was like, no, I am not buying into your marketing. I'm not buying into this and all the negative things. As valuable as formula is, it's absolutely essential. And it's important as well that people have the choice to do whichever they want to do. I would never, ever take that away from people. But at the same time, I was so happy that I was able to do it myself and go it alone. And
Evie, you were going to get in there just a little bit before we go into the COVID restrictions with Emma, but did you have something to say in response?
Yeah, well, first of all, let's be best friends, Emma, because we've got lots to talk about.
Breast friends.
Breast friends. But I just want to echo that, like, breastfeeding is beautiful when you get it. But just for any listeners as well, if they're like, oh, it's easy for you, and when it worked out, it did not work out for me with either boy. And as a first-time mom, I was literally in tears because my baby, my first boy, couldn't latch. He had tongue tie. It annoyed me so much because no one told me or no one checked for 4 days. I got home and I was engorged and ready to stop everything and crying. And it was so, so painful. And in the hospital, they kind of said, we're going to have to give him formula because his blood sugars are low. And he was brought down to ICU and I was on my own and I was just beside myself, my new baby that I wasn't able to feed him, something wrong with me, all of this. So, like, we got past it, and actually we went to exclusively breastfeeding after, you know, a couple of weeks, and that was all fine, but it was just so stressful at the beginning. But after that, we got it nailed, and that's your special time with your baby, and it's just beautiful. But Emma, I was like you, and I succumbed because I thought, well, I only breastfeed up until 6 months, and I only breastfed up until 6 months. You know, it was grand. I had to go away for a work thing anyways. I probably would have stopped, but I wish I had known that I didn't need to. And with my second boy, I really wish that they had kept the lactation consultant on, because I was in such pain at 16 weeks. And I, to be honest, I could have afforded and got another lactation consultant, but I was so sleep deprived and weak and everything. I was just like, I don't want to have to explain myself to another person and explain why I think I'm going to quit now because of the pain. So I'm just going to stop. And I actually regret that now. So yes, there's lovely, beautiful joy with it. But it's when the times are hard that you just need someone there to go, I know it's hard and I understand your pain. And here's a few tips, or let me go and I'll make dinner for you. And you just sit there for a while and see if this will work. That's all you need, just a little bit more support.
Yeah. Well, thanks a million for that. So Emma, back to you in terms of in her shoes, the COVID pregnancy page in her shoes and your experience of pregnancy. So why did you set it up? Because you were at the kind of cold face, at that pinch point. You found yourself in this situation and you obviously realised that there were so many other women in the same situation and they needed a voice, really.
Yeah, so I had my first daughter in April 2020. So I remember the night that the first rafter restrictions came in and whatever, night in March, and I was 34 weeks pregnant and I was sitting on the couch, and I think, like everybody else, we were kind of like, wow, this is happening. Like, wow, you know, everybody, you know, run down, whatever people did, you know, clearing out supermarkets and all the rest of it. It was mad. But it never really dawned on me that, you know, this would impact me and my partner at what is such a critical time in any new family. So we kind of just proceeded as we were. But I, you know, for my next antenatal appointment, I was told that he wasn't allowed to come. And I was like, okay, you know, fair enough. It's a pandemic. But nothing had ever really been explained to me as to what would happen when it came to the birth. So as I so found out, he essentially wasn't allowed in. So he'd be allowed in for active labor. And then I'd be on my own, and I might be on my own. Well, I would be on my own before that. And then I'd definitely be on my own after that. There were no guidelines, no rules, no regulations. It was take what you get. And if he's there, you're lucky. So we went in. I was very fortunate now. We live about an hour from the hospital, and I was very, very determined, particularly as a first time mother, not to fall, not into a trap, but I didn't want to, you know, bring myself into a hospital and potentially be relegated from my partner for however many hours on an antenatal ward. I know as well, hospitals are quite understaffed, so it's not always possible for them to check you to confirm you're in active labour. And I just wasn't for me. So I was like, I'm staying at home. So I woke up on the morning she was born and like I knew I was in labour and sure went in and told himself he's still in bed. And he's kind of like, huh? You know, he was whatever, you know, wake me up when it's really bad. And I was like, okay, yeah, it's pretty bad. But anyway, eventually he got up and he started getting a bit antsy. So I agreed to go in because we are an hour from the hospital. And as it so transpired, I was fairly advanced. So I was fairly chuffed at myself. I was managing well at home, got in and he was allowed to stay in with me. Now it did take a bit of a dark turn in the sense that, and this is kind of where my, estimation of the maternity services kind of went downhill slightly. So I went in and I had to go in by myself, which was fine. Again, I was semi expecting that. And I went up to be assessed. And while I was there, the midwife before I was assessed said, oh, your partner can be here, you know, as a chaperone kind of thing. And I suppose it's to cover their own backsides as well, which is fair. You know, and I was delighted. I didn't actually think that would happen. And while I was waiting for him, she ran through all my birth preferences. And I said, look, minimum intervention, just I need to blow this popsicle stand as quick as I can. I'm young, fit and healthy. This baby's coming out and I'm going home was my feeling on the entire thing. And anyway, she was like, so basically I said, no intervention. I don't need it unless it's an emergency. Please just leave me and my body be. And I'm saying that as not an earth mother. I'm a very practical, salt of the earth type woman. I'm a scientist. I'm a farmer. I was just off the back of a lambing season. Like I know what birth looks like and I know how it changes. So, you know, I didn't need anybody to tell me that I didn't need a rock solid birth plan. So anyway, that was all fine and lovely and all the rest of it. And my partner came in about 2 minutes after we finished that conversation. And I hopped up to be assessed and she said, oh, I can't tell how far along you are or how far dilated you are because your waters are bulging. And in my head, my practical, rational scientist head, I came back because I told active labour in Hollis Street, which was where I was 1 centimetre. So in my tiny brain, I was like, well, how can anything bulge if it's closed? So, you know, am I not already in active labour? And this is where it really turned. She said, look, I'm going to have to break your waters. And I knew that constituted an induction of labour. You know, the cascade of interventions for first time mothers is quite high. And I said, OK, well, what happens if you don't do that? And she's like, if I don't do that, he's leaving. So it was really quite, you know, it felt very threatening at the time. So I consented anyway. There was a massive cascade of interventions. And fortunately, my baby was born very quickly, but I suffered a bleed shortly thereafter, a postpartum hemorrhage. And my partner, thankfully, I say thankfully, it happened while he was in the room because he was allowed to stay and hold a baby. And after they brought me under control, we got 20 minutes together and baby was handed to me. I was wheeled down to a ward by myself and good luck to you. That was it. I was so weak. I was shaking. It was quite traumatic, the entire thing that happened. Nothing was explained to me as it was done. There were hands everywhere. Nobody asked my consent for anything. Breaking my waters wasn't even a version of informed consent that I could. It was really quite horrific. And when I say I'm a salt of the earth kind of rational person, I entered the maternity services with little expectations as to how it would go beyond that I'd be treated with respect and dignity. And I wasn't even afforded that. And that was what really got to me. You know, it can go any way you want. And as they say, people will remember not what you do for them, but how you make them feel. And I will never forget how I was made feel on the day of my daughter's birth. So glossing over that, because I don't want to dwell on it too much.
Yeah. So Emma, I mean, I think that was obviously a really harrowing experience. And, you know, in a way, you had the wherewithal to some degree, having your sciencey kind of farming background, you had a different insight into it, which probably helped you a bit, even though emotionally, I can see how that was a devastating experience to be left in that situation, especially after hemorrhaging and everything. So where did you get from that to kind of looking around and thinking, hang on a second, women are being really left behind here and are not being advocated for? I mean, for me, it's been looking at those podiums night after night on the news. And I know it's a very symbolic thing. And I know that it's not like men don't care about women, because obviously they do. They have partners and sisters. They can understand women's needs to some degree. But symbolically, just seeing that the people making decisions in this pandemic are men predominantly, and they're standing up there every night telling us, it just has really given me sort of such a lack of faith or feeling a bit almost disconnected with the authorities and the people making decisions. So how did it work for you in terms of that feeling of just that women were being left behind and it was such an important time of their lives?
Yeah, so I suppose it was a bit of transition. So I had my baby in April and then kind of towards the summer last year, I don't know if people recall, there was kind of a motion put forward to the Dáil with regards a temporary extension of maternity leave in response to the COVID pandemic. And this was purely because childcare was not a thing. And you have to, you know, it really, like, people might forget now, it seems so long ago, but it also seems like yesterday, you know, childcare closed overnight. And this was particularly detrimental as well. When you think healthcare workers who are at the coal face of this pandemic, 80% of them are women. And overnight, their childcare provision disappeared. I myself, you know, I have a very flexible employer, but, you know, there's so little you can do with an infant at home when you have to go back to work, particularly when state maternity leave isn't particularly well paid. You know, you kind of have to go back to work. So I started kind of dipping my toes into that or during the summer. And, you know, I really got into it. And I actually thought there was a fairly decent chance that we might be listened to because it seemed completely, you know, logical. And this makes sense. And what exactly are you expecting women to do? Because these caregiving roles and women are on maternity leave. This is who they fall to. So what do you expect women to do? Like, you're going to turn around and say no. And then, you know, what's the provision? So anyway, it went to the Dáil and it was kicked out on its backside. Not by much now. It was actually only a narrow loss. But anyway, that happened around, I think it was around July, August, September time. So after that kind of happened, I had a bit of a fire in my belly and I was like, who is making these decisions and why? Like, it really incensed me. So I kind of came back then, I in my head as well, naively, while I was busy doing this maternity leave thing, I thought that, you know, these maternity restrictions would have eased. You know, we're looking back to last summer when things were starting to open again, cases were very low. So I had assumed that in line with good ethical healthcare practice, that people might be afforded the support that, you know, they need, that the World Health Organization says that they need, that every HSE document prior to the pandemic says you need. And it wasn't. And it just kind of struck me like it was bad for me, but I got through it because, you know, beginning of the pandemic, nobody knew where anything was. It was one thing. It wasn't right, but it was what it was. But for people 6 months, 7 months on, it just didn't sit right with me. So I contacted Erin Darcy, who obviously ran the In Her Shoes campaign with the Repeal the Eighth movement. And I just said, look, Erin, you had such a powerful campaign. Any chance you might do this for maternity? And she said, look, it's a fantastic idea. I just don't have time to do it. So I was like, oh, raging, because I was really hoping like I could just push it on to her nicely. She'd done such a fantastic job and I'd a bit on my plate myself. But anyway, she didn't. And coincidentally, at the same time, Ciara McGuane, who is a Limerick woman or Clare woman, I always say Limerick and she kills me. She had also been in touch with Erin, coincidentally. So Erin linked the two of us. Ciara had given birth in April or in March by a C-section, totally alone, down in Limerick. So we got in touch together and basically we said, look, there are stories here that have to be told. We cannot sweep what's happening under the rug and we can't let it happen again to Irish women that we just turn a blind eye. So we set up the page and we fully expected it to fail. Now, to be fair, we were told we were lunatics. I was told that I was trying to kill babies by advocating to have their dad there. It was quite a tough time. Like, where we are now with this campaign has really been a tidal shift in what it was last year. Last year, there was a lot of hate towards us. And that was one of the powerful things as well. All the stories on our page are totally anonymous. So nobody has to reveal their identity because there's a lot of shame, I think, linked to basically women giving out in this country. If you give out, you're weak and you're useless and you're this and you're that.
And you're not going along with the status quo as well, Emma. You're supposed to just shut up and get on with it. And, you know, sure, just grin and bear it is kind of the attitude towards a lot of health issues that women go through, isn't it? So tell us then Absolutely. About the stories that are coming through. And it's interesting you say that tidal shift. I'm fascinated by that, about the hate, you know, that you got for just expressing the needs that are very basic that women need when they're, you know, when they're in maternity services and when they're having babies, and just that companionship, that company, that support and all of that. It's so important. And the fact that they weren't finding safe ways to do that, that wasn't a priority. What kind of stories have you heard? I know you've had lots, so maybe just give us some examples.
Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, and they've been of the worst kind. Like, they'll stay with me forever. And the fact that it just makes me so mad that the stories are still pouring in now and nobody's doing anything about it, it feels. So, I mean, stories of loss. I've heard stories of, you know, people being told that in late gestation that their baby has died and they've had to go outside to the car park and tell the partner that themselves. I've had stories of horrific birth experiences, miscarriages, multiple losses.
I mean, I know, Emma, you could go on for ages and ages of those stories. Yeah. In the introduction to this podcast, I read out one particular horrific situation where the woman seemed to have gone through everything from preeclampsia to pregnancy loss to, you know, it's just, it's horrible. what's your own take on why this is happening and why still the restrictions are there when we have opened up so much more than at any other stage in the pandemic? I mean, it's hard not to ascribe really sort of dark motivations to this or something. I don't know. It's awful. What's your own understanding or take on it?
My understanding is it really comes down to control. Before you might like it, none of the excuses or rationales that have been given for these restrictions hold water. So initially we were told it was to protect staff. Staff are fully vaccinated, pretty much 100% vaccinated across the board. So that lost water, you know, January, February time. We were then told it was to protect women and infants. And that doesn't hold water either, because they're not keeping partners out of hospitals. They're letting them in at an arbitrary time point when they think that your cervix is dilated enough or you've been subject to enough emotional torture, to put it that way, that you're now worthy of having someone to support you. So they're letting them in anyway, and they're letting them in. So as far as I understand, the COVID transmission times are something like 15 minutes. If you're beside somebody who's COVID positive for more than 15 minutes, you're a close contact. So they're letting them in for beyond that time and you know, arbitrary time points. So they're not protecting you from COVID. They refuse to offer partners COVID tests. So again, that really comes back to the protection of women and infants. So they're letting partners in anyway. They don't know their COVID status. And then they're also letting you go home with that same partner. So they really could care less about protecting you or anybody else from COVID. And I'll be damned if somebody tells me they don't have the tools nearly, what are we now, 17, 18 months into a pandemic, to provide one more COVID test. I mean, when a woman presents at their booking appointment, you kind of have an arbitrary time frame that approximately 6 months later, she might present to give birth. So, you know that maybe in 6 months time, you might need an additional COVID test. Last week or the week before, the HSE said that vaccinated partners won't be allowed in. Again, no answer as to why. And I have heard anecdotally, well, not really anecdotally, from trusted sources that have met with hospital management, that really it comes down to an operational thing. They just don't want partners there. And I fully believe that. There's no other reason.
So how do you feel when you hear about, you know, dining indoors and pubs being open and people who are vaccinated allowed to go and have pints with their mates? And how do you feel about that? I mean, it just seems so deeply unfair and wrong. The Waterford Whispers thing that I also introduced in the introduction of this podcast, where, you know, a woman was planning to give birth in a pub so that her partner could be present. Yeah. I mean, it's satire, yeah, but it's actual truth as well, you know?
It is. Yeah. Now, look, if it's safe to reopen and if it makes sense and if all the provisions have been put into place, I welcome the reopening of society. I have no issue with it. And to be honest, I've heard a lot of people say, oh, you can't compare one to the other. You can't compare maternity services to 40,000 people in Croke Park. Well, actually, you can, to be honest now. Let's just bring it back, because that 40,000 crowd in Croke Park has significant societal impacts. If it didn't, it would have been allowed to go ahead months ago. You know, that has ripple effects in terms of COVID transmission. So don't tell me that they're not related is the first thing, because I have to be extra careful now because I know that those events are going ahead. The second thing is, we're not asking for troops of visitors with balloons going in and out of hospital. We're asking for one person, a close contact, under safe circumstances, ideally with the COVID test, and if they're vaccinated, which most partners are now at this stage, and a significant amount of pregnant people are too, all the better, into a hospital to support someone in line with best practice. That's not happening. So it absolutely incenses me that down the road from a maternity unit, you can go sit in the pub, you can go shopping in Penny's for an El Bikini, you can go and see a GA match, you can do whatever you feel like, essentially. And yet you have to leave people to go through some of the most harrowing experiences that you can ever imagine. Like when I had my daughter, I remember naively, I was like, oh God, it's a much better society that I'm bringing her into than I was born into. You know, we've repealed the 8th, marriage equality, equality for women in the workplace has gone up. I was like, Jesus, yeah, this is great. And it just dawned on me, like, we're not that far, like we're one crisis away from having no one with us, from being totally isolated. And, you know, it's just, it boils my blood. I could go on for hours.
Yeah, no, I know. Evie, can I bring you in here? Because I know you have your two hats on. You have your breastfeeding hat on and your woman who gave birth in the pandemic hat on too. What do you think of what Emma has said and where we are now with restrictions still in place and that idea that it's about controlling women? What do you think?
Well, I'm just so sad and I'm so heartbroken. And Emma, I'm really sorry that you had to go through that. Like, it just made, I actually just want to cry and also get really angry at the same time. And to be honest, I really haven't, I'm going to put my hand up here and I'm going to say I haven't really tuned into these stories because I'm actually not able for them. I'm still very emotional from my own isolating, you know, birth process. And I just can't, I really can't understand why women in Ireland are still, you know, not prioritised. And that's just what it feels like. It's just it that we're not a priority, and maybe we don't make enough noise. You know, maybe we need to be more structured in how we're talking about it, or how we're acting on it. I don't know. Two things I want to say, if you don't mind, Roisin. I think this really speaks to the fact that the next national maternity hospital has to be owned and run by the state. Because if at the moment all the guidelines and all the codes and policies are there about what should happen in a maternity hospital, and yet the maternity hospitals are in the majority voluntarily run, and so they can kind of do what they want. And that's not good enough in this day and age. It really isn't. You know, the state is a century old, and yet we've still managed to farm out most of our activities to institutions and charitable organizations. You know, education's another massive one, but health is coming to the fore in this. You know, it's just not right. So the National Maternity Hospital, when it gets built, has to be state run on state land. And I think that, you know, I think that's really clear from what's happening at the moment. And thank you, Emma, for highlighting all of it as well. The second thing I do want to say, Roisin, as well, is that there are a lot of people who are working really hard in the maternity wards who also would like your partners to be in with you. And I had very lovely experiences with my midwives, and I know I'm so lucky for that. And, you know, technically, Carlos could have been told to go home when I came in for my second, because technically I was, you know, maybe not quite at the centimetre mark, but they let him in because they knew I was going to go in the next 20 minutes anyways, and I did. But, you know, there are really good midwives in there, and I know that they want to advocate for the mums, but they're also not being listened to, as Emma's been saying. And I think there's going to be a massive upsurge in home births, because I certainly know that if we have a number three, I'll be doing it at home, because I don't want to have to deal with the stresses that something like this may happen, you know, and I'd like to do that in the comfort of my own home, where I will get to have the people and the person that I need to advocate for me there.
Yeah, well, even on that, and thanks for bringing that up. And I mean, I know we get upset and angry about these issues because they are so upsetting, but it is important to mention the amazing people in the maternity services who we've all experienced. Anyone who's been in, they're lots of great people, but unfortunately, a lot of them are not in the positions of authority to make the decisions around these things. And I think that's a very good point about home births. And to be honest, I would say, having sisters and sister-in-laws who've had several home births very beautifully and successfully and really enjoyably, maybe that is one of those COVID silver linings, that people will see that it is something. I mean, I know it's not for everyone, again, it's sort of similar to the breastfeeding thing, but it is a beautiful thing if you are supported in the right way, and for many, many women it can be a great experience. So hopefully that might be something that might come out of this. Can I just go to you both now and come to you, Emma, first, just about what can we do next? Is there anything anyone can do that we can lobby for, that we can talk about, that we how can we sort of convince the powers that be that these issues are really important and women need to be prioritized?
So I suppose the most important thing and the best bit of advice that I could ever give is just raise your voice and don't stop shouting. It's the most powerful tool you'll have, and it's the one that they might try to take away from you the most. You have a voice and you can use it. Lobby your TD, lobby your local politicians. That's what they're there for. They're there to represent you. So you get in touch with them and you tell them what you need. I suppose as well, as a more far-reaching thing, I think this is really shown in the entire pandemic, from maternity care to children's shoes to children's healthcare to childcare, has really shown why we need more women in politics, because we're not represented. I mean, these men there might have our best interests at heart, or so they think, but they're not listening to what we need, and we need someone in there that does it for us. And I'm anybody listening, I'm just imploring you, stand up and put yourself out there and just make as much noise as you can. You're worth it, you're powerful, and you carry more power than you could ever know. And if you want change, make it, do it, be it. And just don't stop. And I know that sounds very lofty and very up in the air, but that's what we need to do. I mean, we can't have ourselves in another position when the next crisis hits or the next pandemic hits and we're looking back thinking, what should we have done different from this one? And this is what we should have done differently. We need that better representation and we need it there now. We needed it years ago, but we need it there right now. So people need to do it, please.
And Emma, just on a practical sense, is there any sign that these restrictions are going to be lifted anytime soon? Or does it look like, no, that's it for the foreseeable?
They're talking themselves around in circles. So the HSE have said a pile of times now that basically they've put out these national guidelines that should be implemented by all hospitals. Only a minority are not implementing them allegedly, and they should be implementing them all by the end of the week. But what people fail to understand is that those guidelines are still extremely restrictive. So, for example, one of the guidelines that should be complied with is that a partner should be allowed access into A&E or into the early pregnancy assessment unit. And you typically only find yourself in A&E if there's a problem, and same with the early pregnancy assessment unit, which is really, you know, for early loss and that kind of thing mostly. And the problem is partners are allowed in, but what happens is a person arrives to hospital, goes in, and their partner isn't permitted in until an emergency has been confirmed. So in the case of the EPAU, the Early Pregnancy Assessment Unit, you think you're having a loss, the signs are very much there. You'll go in by yourself, have the scan, be told that you've suffered a loss, and then your partner's allowed in. So, yeah, that really gets to me, because it's really a kind of sidestepping of the whole issue, and it's making people look like they're very benevolent and very much women and people-centred and giving the people what they need and want and support, but they're not. So I would urge everybody as well to please read into that and just realise that when they say the restrictions are lifted, they're not. So, but we'll keep going. We're not going to stop.
Even just from you then, what you think people can do, and also in this situation, in this in terms of the restrictions, but also for breastfeeding. Breastfeeding week is on until August 7th, and there's a lot of talk about it. You mentioned Breastival and Sabine Higgins as well, getting very, who always is so supportive of it. What about people listening who feel like they'd like to help or get involved or do something?
So I'm with Emma on this, and I'm having a lot of conversations about this recently, but I do think grassroots movements and activism is the way forward. But activism can take a lot of different forms, you know, because I think, you know, sometimes we can say, well, I'm not that loud person, or I don't like marches, or I wouldn't wear the merchandise. But actually, activism takes lots of different forms. And when you do it in a grassroots way, it's actually just about having conversations. If that's at your dinner table, at a coffee morning, or on a walk, or, you know, whatever it is. But I think definitely engaging with our legislators, because that's what politicians are. They're actually there to legislate, and we need to tell them exactly what we want to legislate. And I think for me now, because I've been thinking about this a lot, we need to lobby, but how's the best way to do that? And I'm not on commission or anything like that. But for me, I joined the National Women's Council just as a member around the repeal the 8th, because I just thought, you know what? They were the strong woman's voice that got to the tables with the decision makers. And they're still at those tables. They're at the tables in the HSE. They're at the tables in the Department of Health with the politicians. And, you know, they're very easy to engage with, and they take on a lot of ideas. So that's just what I would say. You know, don't be afraid to have the conversations, and remember that we get things done by grassroots. There's a book, and I can't remember the name of it now, but I read it. It was on the first 20 years of the state and how women just got gently nudged out little by little. And there were so many women at the time who were speaking out, you know, were part of Coming Amon, and we're really trying to make noise to make sure that they didn't get erased. So I just think we need to take up their flag and get back in there and just make sure we get heard. You know, you don't have to run for office to be a voice.
Well, that's true. But now that you are breast friends, maybe you could both set up a political party or something. I would be totally there for you. I'd be voting the crap out of you two. I'll tell you something. I mean, I think you're right. I think it's such an important point, even about activism coming in many, many forms. It's not necessarily about shouting. It's not even necessarily about going on marches. But there's many, many ways to support and raise awareness of these really important issues. We just can't let we can't let things roll backwards. And that's what kind of is so, without being too bleak about it, it's sort of almost, it's terrifying listening to both of you on those levels, just to see how things can so easily be rolled back. If you think of the culture culture in the 70s with breastfeeding, how that was very quickly done, and how our mums now have a view of breastfeeding that's not correct. And then to do with this as well, because it's kind of handier for the authorities in the hospitals to not have those advocates and partners around, how easily they've been pushed out the door, and there doesn't look like any sign of them coming back. So it's just about being vigilant too, isn't it? Just realising that the rights we think we have are very fragile, and we need to keep raising our voices. And I just want to say thank you so much to both of you for everything that you're doing. And maybe in a few months you could both come back on and things will be a bit better. Let's try and be glass half full about it. But for now, thanks very much, Emma and Evie.
Thanks so much, Roisin.
Thanks very much.
That's all we have time for. The podcast is produced by me, Roisin Ingle, by Suzanne Brennan and Jennifer Ryan, with JJ Vernon on sound. You can contact us on social, on Instagram, Facebook or Twitter using @ITWomen's Podcast. We're on email to thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com, and we love hearing from you. Until next time, mind yourselves, and thanks very much for listening.